Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. I'm Jack Luke, Bike Radar's deputy editor, and today I'm joined by a wonderful friend. I'm going to say it, Simon. Probably my favourite podcast guest, Simon Von Bromley. And today we're going to be talking through the latest road tech news from the last few weeks on BikeRadar.com. So Simon, I mean, other than glowing from my praise, how are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely fine. Blushing, Jack.
Blushing. You should see him. He's the colour of beetroot.
No, I'm good. I saw a video on My Windsock, which is an excellent cycling website that does kind of like race predictions with kind of weather.
It's genuinely really good.
Even good.
I use it sometimes for just touring. It's very good.
He had reposted a video from BBC that had basically been the wettest 18 months on record in the UK. That is genuinely terrifying because, you know, crops are failing and stuff like that. But for cycling,
it's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. It's been terrible. So, yeah.
You've had to suffer through the worst of it with Bike of the Year testing concluded not terribly long ago for you, but also all of our Bike of the Year shoots have just finished. And they're in mid Wales for the video and photography shoot, and it looked quite wet, so I can't say I'm terribly envious. How was the arduous testing for Bike of the Year this year, Simon?
Yeah, it was kind of wet and cold, but it wasn't too arduous. I remember last year's one, when I was doing the aero road bikes category, it was snowing quite a lot.
Perfect.
I was going out on icy roads on Ribble's Ultra SLR and stuff like that, and that was kind of a bit sketchy. So, like, yeah, it was wet and cold, but it wasn't too bad.
Wonderful. I mean, also you did get to ride your bike lots, which
I did. Some nice bikes as well.
Well, no teasers. Wait for the full Bike of the Year announcement in May. There will be plenty of podcasts around that time discussing this year's test, the winners and so on. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, you will have also noticed that last Friday was our first kind of expanded Q&A, which will have an associated feature on the site very, very soon.
How come I never get invited onto those?
Well, Simon, because we don't have a 4-hour-long podcast where you lecture people on their questions. No, maybe a future one, but it was really good. We had some very interesting questions across road, gravel, and mountain bikes. Warren and Tom had some good insight. It's definitely worth a listen. I enjoyed hosting that one. But today, our topic is going to be the latest road tech news published on Bike Radar. And we're going to kick things off with two new endurance bikes from Envy and BMC. We're going to go into Campagnolo's first power meter, where Simon will talk at me for about 45 minutes. And then finally, we're going to go back actually a few weeks to Shimano's ESSA group set, a new budget 8-speed group set, which, to be honest, I didn't really see coming at all. Came out of the woodwork with no warning at all. Anyway, we'll kick things off with the new Envy Frey. Simon, what's the score with Envy's latest bike? It's third bike as well.
Yeah, so Envy already had the Mele, which is its kind of road racing bike, and then the Mog, which is gravel racing bike. This kind of sits in the middle of those as a kind of all-road endurance bike. So it's got clearance for up to 700 times 40C tyres, with a 1x group set or a 38C with a 2x group set, but the geometry is optimized for a 31 to 35 millimeter tire. So that kind of what has become the, you know, kind of a new standard for endurance road bikes like the Trek Demane SLR, latest Giant Defy Advanced SL, for example. Compatible with 1 or 2x drivetrains, threaded T47 bottom bracket, lightweight carbon fiber construction with aero tubing. You know, it looks identical to the Melee and the Mog.
If you're familiar with Envy's bikes, like, honestly, it's kind of indistinguishable from the other two.
Yeah, it uses the exact same design language, shall we say. But it's taller at the front end than the Melee. So it's, you know, the fit is more forgiving than a kind of pure race bike. But because it's optimized around those kind of narrower tires than the Mog, for example, it is still more of a road machine than a pure gravel bike, which is, you know, optimized for kind of tires from 40 to 45C.
Yeah, I realized I just said it was the three bikes. They now have four bikes, of course, the Mog and the two road bikes that go with it. I mean, one of my questions with this is, like, what is its point of differentiation from the other two bikes? Because particularly with the custom road, now that is a fully custom bike, quite expensive, made one off. Why have they developed this bike essentially to sit alongside the other two? You know, is anyone really calling out for a weird all-roady kind of endurance-y bike? Am I just being a bit exclusionary, assuming that race bikes are the only thing that are actually interesting?
I don't know. It's the kind of funny one. But we have seen a bit of resurgence with endurance road bikes recently. So I wonder if there is still just a large appetite from consumers for these types of bikes. I mean, to me, I've got a racing bike, a Giant TCR, and then I've recently built up a gravel bike. And these kind of ones that sit in the middle of that seem a bit of a kind of, you know, you don't kind of get the best of either. Mm-hmm. But actually, maybe this is the kind of bike, you know, a bit like the Giant Defy that, you know, maybe I shouldn't be riding a race bike like a TCR, and I, you know,
yeah, but it looks cool.
It does look cool, but you know, I should be riding maybe a Giant Defy, you know, or you know, you shouldn't have a Madone, you should have a Demane, for example. Yeah. So it's maybe that it's that kind of bike where they think, you know, because, you know, we're looking at it in terms of like tire clearance and things like that, but the geometry of this is going to be more suitable for the kind of majority of, you know, amateur riders, yeah, I suppose. Whereas, you know, obviously we're seeing the Melee being raced at the World Tour now. It's quite an aggressive bike. But yeah, I'm very new to the gravel world, but obviously, you know, is a 40 millimeter tire big enough for gravel?
I mean,
it
yeah,
depends,
from,
right?
for most people. I think Oscar made a good point in the Road Machine review he published on site, where we'll talk about the Road Machine after the Envy. But there's a gravel build for that, and that could take 40 mil tires as well. But it, you know, it isn't just about tire clearance. That isn't all that goes into making a good gravel bike. Of course, we're casting judgment on this without having really seen the bike in the flesh or having ridden it at all. Perhaps it's a tremendously good all-rounder bike. But I'm kind of with you there, where these middle ground bikes that don't quite lean into gravel, don't quite lead into road, they're sort of all road, but not really marketed as all road. Like, I'm not really sure who's out there riding 38 or 40 millimeter wide slicks, unless they're like committed Audax riders, randonneurs, but they're more likely to be riding sort of traditional steel. Yeah, I don't know. It feels like a bit of a bike I don't see very frequently here in the UK. Perhaps the situation is different in the US, which one imagines is the primary market for this bike.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I think, you know, endurance road bikes were kind of had a really big thing when they were being used at Roubaix in the Spring Classics, you know, and they were very marketable around that time. You know, in the UK, they became kind of known as like sportive bikes, right? But then they kind of went out of fashion a little bit as, you know, road racing bikes basically got more tire clearance and you didn't need to get the endurance bike in order to get the wider tire clearances. But it does feel like they're kind of coming back into fashion. And so I wonder if there's just a kind of, yeah, you know, this is just what kind of consumers are, you know, saying they want by where they're spending their money.
Mm. People do buy SUVs for this very reason, don't they? They want to buy bikes which are aspirational and lean into their imagination of horizon-chasing multi-terrain adventures. Perhaps it's just very clever marketing. Simon, how much does this bike cost?
So Envy isn't offering full builds, but you can have a chassis.
Another good Americanism.
Well, yeah, I'm not a big fan of that phrasing.
You could call out Simon if he ever writes that in a piece of content on the site, leaving him abusive comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they mean frame set.
They mean frame set.
But I think it includes the kind of two-piece handlebar and stem. It retails for $5,500, just under 5,800 euros, £5,500, or just under 10,000 Australian dollars.
Which is so much money. But it's not because it's the same, but it's so much money.
Yeah, although it's, you know, is that much more than what you would pay for a kind of specialized S-Works tarmac SLA
no,
frame set?
No, to be fair. No, you're right.
And you know, Envy doesn't have the economies of scale of Giant, to put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. So it kind of is what it is. But yeah, like I don't know how much more their custom road is, but you know, I presume the wait time is longer for a custom road. You've got to make more decisions.
Yeah, so a lot of money, but hardly a surprise, really, let's be honest. An Envy bike was never going to be a value proposition. From one expensive bike onto another, we go on to BMC's new road machine, which our wonderful Oscar Huckle went out to ride and put a whole bunch of miles on, delivering a full review off the back of the launch. He rated the bike very highly. He's a big BMC kind of guy. And he's got a very good review where he outlines what he liked and what he didn't about the bike. I'm not going to give you any spoilers. That's for Oscar to outline. And of course, there's a link to that in the podcast description. But Simon Von Bromley, what are the key stats from this bike?
So kind of similar to the Envy bike, BMC's new road machine is still its endurance road bike, but it's this time been granted 40 millimeters of tire clearance, downtube storage, and a greater focus on improving compliance. And interesting, not much focus on aerodynamics, although it has received an integrated one-piece cockpit.
Yes, so the one-piece cockpit is a sort of variation of BMC's ICS integrated system, where there's flat faces down either side of the fork, and the cables run through the bar, as you'd expect, through the stem, and then down either side of the fork steerer. Oscar, by his own admission, I should say, not a big fan of integration as a whole, but says this is one of the least hateful systems to work on. You know, it's been around with BMC's bikes for a while, and it does look pretty neat at the front. In terms of compliance, there's quite an interesting note from Oscar in his news piece about this, where the seat tube tapers down very, very narrow just above the bottom bracket junction. Now, BMC says it was able to do this to improve compliance because UCI rules now dictate that tubes can be in the front triangle, less deep. It's quite hard to describe this, but kind of viewed side on, less deep than 25 millimeters, whereas previously they had to be a minimum of 25 and they could go down as low as 10 now.
I think it's interesting when brands such as BMC says, well, the UCI rules allow us to do this, because this bike's never going to get raced in a UCI World Tour race, as far as I can tell.
So, I wonder if it just matters to people. Like, you know, if you're sort of a fresh-faced green cyclist, or perhaps even a seasoned cyclist who takes racing pedigree seriously, maybe that sort of sticker is quite important to you. I don't know. Because, yeah, you are right. Like, none of BMC's sponsored teams will ride this. They will choose the team machine for their kind of go fast racing, because they don't need to take sandwiches in their down tube. That's just for us who don't have team cars following along.
Maybe they've got an eye on the kind of, you know, ever expanding UCI gravel series. Maybe some BMC pros might use this for certain events. You know, there are kind of certain, you know, we saw like in, you know, kind of the first Gravel World Championships, which took place in Treviso.
It did, well remembered.
You know, a lot of people rode bikes for that. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of bike that could comfortably take on a gravel race like that, in inverted commas, if you can really call that a gravel race.
Oh, a topic for another time. There's a couple other really nice features about this bike. The downtube storage Simon mentioned. There are quite a lot of gravel bikes out there which have downtube storage. It's become almost de facto in modern day mountain bikes. It is really, really useful. I've used it on mountain bikes before, and like I like strapping bikes to a bike, but like for spares, for example, it's a nice place to store stuff away. But the new road machine is one of very few road bikes which feature this. The Trek Domani is the kind of biggest other example we could recall with downtube storage. Well, what do you think about that, Simon? Would you ever stash your snacks down there?
Probably wouldn't stash snacks in there.
In case you get a mice infestation in your frame. Yeah,
I can see it as, you know, I always carry a saddlebag, and I can see it as a useful place for that. I don't really have a problem carrying a saddlebag.
No,
and I kind of tend to like, I like to be able to just port it quickly between different bikes, you know? So, yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of a nice idea.
It's nicer than the Endurace top tube storage Game Boy cover.
Yeah.
You know? The Game Boy battery cover.
It looks like the battery cover from a Game Boy, doesn't it, that one? So, yeah, which has just like a little clip. I'm kind of indifferent to it. I've not had a bike with it. I haven't missed it, you know, like, I'll just carry it, like I say, a saddlebag or a bar bag is kind of like fine for me. But it certainly does keep the bike looking clean. And I'm sure for a lot of people, that's a kind of welcome thing. And, you know, if you have a dedicated spares kit for this bike and you just always keep it on, you know, it does mean you're, you know, unlikely to forget it.
So forgetting things is a good way to ruin a ride. Years ago, I went on the mountain bike side. I went on a Specialized Stump Jumper launch. And it was the first bike I'd ridden with downtube storage. And Specialized put a little bocadillo in every single bike, a little sandwich in there. It was a lovely little surprise alongside a multi-tool. Another nice little neat note. To be honest, I'm not massively sold on this, as I don't love sort of proprietary tech along these lines. But I will admit it does look quite cool, but BMC's integrated a STVZO compliant rear light into the back of the seat post, and the bottom half of this has a sort of like keyed portion which fits into a slot in the back of the frame. Without it, it looks fine. It does look fine without the light, and Oscar says it fits pretty well. As ever, my sort of beef with this is like, one, is the battery replaceable in the light? Probably not. 5 years from now, when that light kind of no longer holds sufficient charge, will you be able to get a replacement? Probably, but in 15 years, probably not. Personally, I don't see a problem with strapping on a light, but it's nice. People like integration. I'm not going to yuck somebody's yum in that regard. And overall, like, it's a bike which feels quite BMC-like. It looks like a BMC road bike.
Yeah, I think the thing that I find weird about the light is it has a claimed 90-minute runtime, which seems terminally short. But then I wonder if that's whether it's just like fully on,
yeah,
not
surely
flashing.
That must be on. 90 is nothing. It's an hour and a half.
For an endurance road bike, yeah, that seemed very, very short.
Oh, I hadn't actually caught that in the news story. Interesting.
But it's kind of USB-C rechargeable, so if I guess, you know, you could be carrying a little battery pack with you.
Put a bigger battery on your bike, like a light. Oh, whatever.
Or a dynamo.
Yeah, dynamo. No dynamo routing on this one. Actually, this is something I took umbrage with on this bike, right? So the cheaper, there's two frame set options for this. The one and the two, classic BMC sort of naming conventions. The one is the super fancy one. The two is the slightly cheaper one. The two has mudguard mounts. Hooray! Mudguard mounts are great. I love mudguard mounts, but the one doesn't. Which I took umbrage with, and Oscar said, well, I wouldn't be putting mudguard mounts on a £13,000 bike. Why not?
Why not?
Why not? Doesn't make any difference to whether the bike's, you know, good or not. And BMC have said that the most expensive, or the more expensive frame set option, has sort of strength and tubes to let clip-on mudguards go on. But they suck. No, yeah. Clip-on mudguards are good.
So and they will ruin the frame.
They will ruin
They will
the frame.
Ruin the paint.
Yeah.
Which you don't want to do on a £13,000 road bike.
So I really took issue with this. I think all bikes should have mudguard mounts. That really irks me. Any thoughts from you, Simon?
I think it's a weird choice. I'm kind of more sanguine about this than you are.
That's because you don't ride in the rain if you can avoid it.
Well, yeah, which I can't. but I agree that if you're going to put them on one version of it because you think that mudguards are a good thing, which they are, mm-hmm. then it seems like really strange to then say, but this one doesn't.
Yeah.
This one can't do it. And I think that, like, you know, on a bike such as this, I don't see what you're losing by having the mounts. You know, if Oscar had this bike or anyone else and they don't ever want to run mudguards on it, you know, the presence of mounts doesn't force you into doing it. You know, we've seen the Trek has done very well hidden mudguard mounts.
Yeah, on the Damani.
Yeah, and I think Canyon has done them too on certain bikes.
Yes, they do. I'm trying to remember how they do it. But I think they use like little holes that you put a grub screw into the side of to sort of clamp the stays of the mudguard in place. I'm pretty sure about that. I'd have to check. It's been a while since I had a look. But nonetheless, they have provision for mudguards, is the
kind
of thing.
Yeah, and they don't really take anything away from the bike, but they give you that extra option. So I don't really know why more brands don't just do that, to be honest.
I want to hear from you. What do you think? Should all bikes have mudguards? Or are we simply speaking from a position of living in a sad, wet island? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Maybe a topic for a future podcast. Send them through to podcast@bikerider.com. On to our next talking point, and that is the news that Camping Nola has launched its first ever power meter. Now, Simon's going to give you the key details. A little bit of interesting insight into this. We obviously went on the Super Record launch. We've seen the bike plenty. One of the things we noticed at the time was that on both crank arms, there's a little sort of hollowed out section on the back of the cranks. And at the time, we sort of speculated, like, it's probably going to be a power meter mount. Fast forward maybe like 6 months or so, a very generous reader pointed out that a leaked image had ended up on the Canyon website for the top end Ultimate, which is fitted with Super Record wireless. And they noticed that the backs of those crank arms had what appeared to be pods for the power meter into the back of the crank arm. So we were feeling very smug. We'd wrapped it all up. You know, we'd caught Camping Nola red-handed. We were wrong. Even we can get things wrong, Simon. What has happened with Camping Nola, and what do you think was going on with that leak earlier this year?
So what has happened is that Camping Nola has released its HPPM Power Meter Spider crankset. Now, this is purely speculation, but what I think may have happened is that Camping Nola may have come across the problem that carbon cranks are quite difficult to build power meters into. It's not something we've seen very often. And in fact, I believe Stages is the only company to market a power meter crank, and it only offers it as a left crank. There are no other...
Why is that?
Because so from...
I have to say I've never noticed this. So you're going to be teaching fresh. This is even a pretend question. This is a real question.
as far as I'm aware, it's because carbon cranks don't bend in predictable ways.
Oh.
And in the same way that alloy cranks do. So it's not simply the case of with an alloy crank, you can just take the kind of strain gauges and arrangement and just port it directly, you know, glue it straight onto another one. Apparently the carbon cranks, they just don't react to torque in the same way as an aluminium crank does. And so all I can think of is that you can put the strain gauges on there, put all the sensors on there, you can get it measuring something.
But if it's not consistent and
accurate, then I wonder if Campagnolo just came across too many hurdles and they couldn't bring it to market. Yeah. Whereas spider-based power meter technology, very, very well proven.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of the first SRM way back in the late 80s was a spider-based power meter. So I wonder if Campagnolo just thought, you know what, actually, previously, Campagnolo had a kind of agreement with Power2Max and SRM to make spider-based power meters around their carbon crank sets. And I wonder if Campagnolo just thought that actually this design works, has been working fine. You know, we're spending all of this effort just to get kind of like separate left-right power measurement. Is that what people need? Maybe, you know, it's better. It's way better to have accurate power data than inaccurate left-right split. So I kind of wonder that. Now, in terms of the kind of the power meter spider that Campagnolo has released, on the face of it, you know, you could look at that and think, well, that's kind of old fashioned technology now because everyone's moving to pedals, dual sided cranksets. But it does have some interesting things. It has a claimed accuracy rating of plus or minus 1%, which is kind of in line with, you know, most high end power meters. Obviously, that is a claim. We haven't tested it. We don't know if that's accurate. But Campagnolo says it uses 16 strain gauges, which I believe is more than most spider-based power meters. I couldn't tell you how many are in a SRM or a Quark. But,
I'm so disappointed, Simon. I thought that's the sort of information you'd retain in your big encyclopedic brain.
But apparently, I have seen it said by other people who are into power meters that 16 is quite a lot. And so is it the case that more strain gauges are better? Like, I don't know. Like, maybe. You know,
I guess you can average them all out.
Yeah. And I think it reads at a kind of quite a high hertz as well.
Resolution.
Yeah, high resolution. So theoretically, it has better measurement tools that could make it more accurate. But we'll have to kind of wait and see, really, because it is ultimately, you know, the tools are just the tools. It's how they're kind of implemented that really makes a difference, because my Quark is excellent.
Yeah.
Super, super reliable. I had an old SRM that was pretty good, but didn't handle temperature fluctuations very well, for example, because, you know, back in the day, algorithms to blah, 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 blah. But I also have pedals that use, you know, different arrangements, and they're really, really good. You know, so it is with a power meter, it is all about the implementation. I think the kind of wild thing about this power meter is just how much it costs. And it's $2,449 or €2,240.
That's so much money.
With UK pricing still to be confirmed. And that's just so much money because, yeah, you know, you could get a set of Favero Astioma Duo power. Well, you get a set of Favero Astioma Duo power meter pedals for around £700.
Yeah.
And they are
excellent,
flawless, you know, really, really good. And this is kind of like, you know, we were joking about this in one of our little chats, but this is like the same price as what you would pay if you went on SRM's website and spec'd every pointless aftermarket upgrade, like THM fibula cranks and, you know, titanium spindles and carbon tie chain rings to your SRM power meter. So, you know, it's going to need to be flawless in order to justify that price.
It does have a 4,000 watt upper range, Simon, which I'm sure you would be tickling with no bother.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be fair, most power meters top out at around 2 to 2,500 watts. So, you know, Campagnolo is designing this. Well, you know, there are pros, you know, if you're a Tour de France sprinter or like a track sprinter, you know, there are pros who can break over 2,000 watts, right? We know that's a thing. And so, you know, Campagnolo Super Record is designed for that, like, absolute pinnacle of performance, and, you know, I respect that, but yeah, it's irrelevant to 99% of people.
What's top power, like, you know, instant power number that you've ever hit?
Probably like 1400 watts or something for most single second power. I can't do that anymore. Back in the day, this is one of the things, like, yeah, I mean, like, old man talking here, I'd have been a lot better racer if I'd spent time working on my sprints. When do you kind of look back and, oh yeah, every race ends in a sprint. I didn't realize that quickly enough, unfortunately.
I'll have to find it. I'll put a link in the description. It'll take me a minute to recall, but it was a really good video years ago that Joe Norledge and Ruben Backdeus did about maximum power and, like, whether that could predict your performance as a cyclist. It's really good. This is like 2017, I think, possibly. They're very different built riders. And it was really interesting seeing what the outcome of that test was. I'll find that. That's a really classic video. I'll have to.
And yeah, another power-related video that I really like is the video of Robert Forsterman powering a toaster.
So, oh, that's a classic. That's an absolute classic. Maybe we'll put that one. You can Google that one. That's a really good one. Anyway, of course, the link to the news story for the power meter is in the description along with everything else we've discussed. Now, finally, we're going to finish up with something from the very, very expensive to the very, very cheap. We're going to Shimano's new ESSA group set. So if you're familiar with Shimano's group sets, in the last year or so, Q's has replaced a lot of the sort of mid to cheaper end stuff on Shimano's flat bar and soon to be drop bar components. But ESSA is an all new one by drivetrain specifically for our specific 8-speed group set that's going to replace Acera, Altus, and Tourney TX. Not components commonly seen on road bikes, but certainly seen on some cheaper stuff. And this one's really come out of nowhere. Like, we didn't really expect this from Shimano. And there's some quite interesting questions yet to be resolved around, like, how this fits in with Q's. But on the face of it, this real budget essence of active, to use Shimano's tasteless marketing speak, group set actually looks pretty good. Like, if you consider visually, it looks very refined and not a great deal different from, say, Dior or cheaper 105 stuff. The fact that it's backwards compatible with previous 8-speed stuff is a really good thing. There's tons of spares out there. Bear in mind as well that 8 and 9-speed Shimano stuff is compatible with, like, everything from way, way back, which will include old road stuff if you want to make a weird old mashed up one by bike. And it just looks quite good for what's a cheap thing. Where I think Shimano's doing interesting work is at this lower end of the market now. Like, certainly Campagnolo, but even SRAM, like the truly budget end of the market, mass market, has been completely abandoned by them. And Shimano is really doing good stuff there. The true essence of trickle-down tech, if you believe in such things. What do you reckon, Simon? What do you think of ESSA?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it looks, like, excellent. If you think of, you know, a Shimano Tourney derailleur, like, it looks so cheap at the moment. And so if you're thinking that a bike that would have had that is now going to get this, that is a huge step up. And, you know, it basically it's taken the design language of Q's and just made it kind of cheaper and more accessible. And as you say, you kind of, oh, it's like, why wouldn't they make it compatible with Q's? It doesn't make any sense. You know, the Q's were supposed to unify everything and now they've kind of had it. But you're right that keeping this backwards compatible with things that already existed
is arguably a good thing.
So I can see why they've done that.
Bear in mind, I was just going to say as well, Tourney. So while ESSA is currently just flat bar components, Tourney was a bit of a do-all group set with drop bar shifters as well. Now, they've not released, or Shimano hasn't released, new drop bar shifters to go along with ESSA. However, I would be stunned if they didn't in some time release matching drop bar shifters for this. You can totally see this group set being spec'd on, like, let's say a budget Voodoo gravel bike. It's one by, it's wide range, it's got kind of like clutch-like-ish mechanism in there. Like, that would make for a really genuinely excellent group set at the budget end. Shimano's quite strange in that it will sort of trickle out stuff occasionally. Like, it doesn't do like one big all-encompassing launch with absolutely all products. Q's is a good example where we haven't seen the drop bars yet. Alongside this launch, we also saw some cool stuff for the Q's range for people with smaller hands. Nice thing to see. But I wouldn't be surprised if this is just the sort of first we hear of ESSA, and we're going to see more soon in terms of drop bar.
I agree. Like, I would love to see drop bar shifters for all of this stuff, including Q's. I mean, obviously, like, I'm a very drop bar focused kind of guy, so I'm talking selfishly, but that is the kind of thing that is still missing from this. But, you know, like, it is obviously fair to say that for the majority of people, flat bar is bikes, right?
Yeah. Flat bar is bikes.
So
that was good.
I can see why, like, you know, and integrated brake and shift levers are complicated. You know, they're always one of the most expensive parts of a group set. So yeah, I can see why they perhaps, I don't want to say they're dragging their heels on it, but like it hasn't come first. But yeah, like I think this stuff is genuinely excellent. Like, you know, I have a cheap e-bike with a kind of 8-speed microshift drivetrain on it. Like, and it's like surprisingly good. You know, it's surprisingly good. And I think it's great to see more, you know, innovation and development at that lower end of the market, because
really cheap stuff has historically been appallingly bad. Like, bike put you off for bikes bad often.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with the kind of, you know, the price rises the kind of bike industry has experienced in recent years, I'm sure there is a kind of clamour from manufacturers and consumers, riders, we should say, for just cheaper bikes in general. And like the difference, you know, for just riding around town and like, you know, getting into biking, you don't need 11 speed.
You certainly do not.
So this stuff looks really good. And I think that's kind of important as well, like mimicking that premium aesthetic of Q's, Dior. It doesn't feel like you're just being kind of like slapped with a cheaper component just to kind of, you know, cut cost. It's nice to see Shimano's making this stuff look nice, and I'm sure it will perform excellently as well.
Yeah, it's unlikely we'll do a full group set review standalone. Like, this is clearly going to be quite an OEM-focused product, though, as ever with Shimano, it will be available aftermarket from somewhere. I think from a road and gravel perspective, provided drop bar shifters come for this, like, it's going to be a really good thing for cheap bikes, in my view.
Did you get Q's for your tandem?
Yes, I did.
Have you used it?
Yeah, we've used it a lot. I am going to write a bike radar build quite soon. But yeah, I've gone for... It's slightly unusual because it's tandem. We've got a crossover crankset. So I've had to do a bit of futzing with the cranksets. But overall, it's excellent. It's really good. The whole selling point with Q's is that it is much harder wearing and much more forgiving of quite poor riding and tandems. You know, it's quite hard to be finessed with your pedaling technique. And thus far, like, it is seriously impressive, particularly shifting down the cassette, so to a harder gear when you're climbing, like on cheaper or older group sets, you have that horrible feeling of it sort of like falling away as you're pedaling. It is so forgiving for that. The one thing that's not bad, it's just unusual, is that Q's uses a different cable pull ratio. I can't recall if it's 2-to-1, as in 2 mil at the shifter, 1 mil at the derailleur, or the other way around. So it results in quite a vague feeling at the shifter. However, when you're actually shifting, because it is quite a big ratio between the two of them, it's quite forgiving in cable setup. And yeah, it's just really good. It's really good. I'll share full thoughts on this another time. But yes, thus far, Q's excellent. ESSA doesn't use the same Link Glide technology as Q's. It uses the traditional sort of Hyperglide 8-speed stuff. Again, for this kind of level of bike, nothing wrong with that. Proven technology, and there's absolutely bloody mountains of it out there as well. So nice cheap option for replacements. Anyway, that was a quick overview of some of the top road news story on Bike Radar in recent weeks. We elected not to cover the absolute deluge of mountain bike tech in recent weeks because me and Simon aren't very good at talking about suspension tech. But there's been so much, like absolutely crazy amounts of mountain bike tech, and we'll bring you a full news pod roundup of that soon. But in the meantime, maybe subscribe to our newsletter where you get a regular update of the latest stuff on bikeradar.com. In the meantime, Simon von Bromley, I mean what I said, great guest as always.
Well, you're my favourite host.
Oh, God, look at this loving. Thank you very much for listening. We'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.